Hello, you're listening to Sean from Galactic Chat, and today I'm interviewing the award-winning Margot Lanigan. Welcome to the podcast, Margot.
Thank you, Sean. Lovely to be here.
Okay, I'll launch straight into it. You're fairly well recognised within the Australian scene, and increasingly so in America, but this year you were shortlisted for the inaugural Stella, which, despite being more open to genre than the Miles Franklin, still feels, at least to me, like a bit of a mainstream prize. And I wanted to ask, what did achieving that shortlisting mean to you?
Well, first of all, it was just really cool to have a book on a shortlist and caught up in the Stella Prize launch and sort of ongoing celebrations around the prize. But I had thought that it would be really cool to win that, but shortlisting is a step closer anyway. I thought it would be good for not just for me, because the check's a nice generous one, but for YA writing as well, which often gets it's sort of just put over to one side by mainstream readers. And it would also be a wonderful thing for genre writing, which also suffers from the same sort of thing from literary mainstream readers.
I was just going to say, I've just finished reading George Turner's The Sea in Summer, and interesting to see a writer come from the what I'd say the literary side of the fence and then into science fiction. So it's good to see us almost going back the other way.
Yeah, I think that I'm the sort of person who likes the boundaries to be as blurred as possible. I think they're useful up to a point, but I think crossing over them is more useful.
Next question was, I thought that the two big hitters on this year's Australian Awards nomination lists, Sea Hearts and Bitter Greens, were those two books. Both have their feet firmly grounded in folktale, and I wanted to ask you what you thought it was about this folktale. What quality draws your attention, and why do you think it's a bit of a hit with readers?
I think they're hit with readers of a particular background, because that background includes having those stories read to them very, very early in their lives. So, you know, when they're completely open to being terrified and believing in magic. And so I think those stories have get in really early and get in really thoroughly, get right into people's bones. And you can use the power that they have there to animate stories about other things.
Okay, and with the folktale, well, your own writing, what draws you? I suppose that's why I enjoy it, for example. But is it just that you can? That's the effect that you can produce is what draws you to the
genre? Well, I think
genre?
The sort of the reliability of the effect. The reason that I wrote Tender Morsels, my first dark fantasy novel, was because I needed a structure. I was at a bit of a crisis of confidence and didn't think I could put a novel together under my own steam. So I needed a story that had a bit of a track record to work for me, to provide the framework for a story that I was feeling very unconfident writing. So I think there's something about having that reliable engine to your story that you can adapt to your own ends, which is very attractive to writers. It means that you don't have to originate the framework yourself necessarily. So it's kind of a cowardly thing to do.
I don't know if I'd agree with that, but I'm glad you did it that way anyway, because I thoroughly enjoyed Tender Morsels. Well, thoroughly enjoyed.
Yes, I know, it's not really the right word, is it?
But I don't regret having read it, put it that way. Now, one of the other awards that Sea Hearts won this year was the Norma K. Hemming, and that's, for listeners who don't know, for excellence in the exploration of race, gender, sexuality, class and disability in Australian speculative fiction. And I wondered, what was the impetus for the themes relating to gender in Sea Hearts? Were the interactions between men and women, boys and their mothers, something that grew organically, or was there a kernel of something there that you thought, I have to find a story to express this?
It usually works the other way around, that that I go for the story and my issues come blurting out inadvertently The boys and their mothers was definitely a side effect of the fact that I am the mother of boys and they are reaching the stage where they are in the process of disengaging from the family that I made for them. So they, at the moment, they're both actually living at home, but they have been moving in and out for a while. So I think that there's a very strong correlation between the idea of the going back into the sea and then coming back out again is all just very tied up in quite a banal way with the circumstances of my life. But definitely the Selkie story made me wonder about the assumptions about relationships between men and women behind those stories. They're always, there's a lot that goes unsaid. I think they say a lot about men and women's difficulties finding commonality sometimes and always being slightly mysterious to each other. And that's sort of rather beautifully expressed in the idea that they're actually a different species. And it's something that people are always saying to one another. They just don't quite get why, you know, their bloke doesn't see what's going on in their heart when all their girlfriends do. But it just seemed to be a useful way of prodding at lots of uncomfortable places in human relationships, but men's and women's was probably the most uncomfortable territory that I was covering.
Yeah, well, I did find it more enjoyable in that sense than Tender Morsels, but I think you hit the nail on the head with that one. Speaking of nails, there's a video that's gone viral on the internet. I don't know if you've seen it, with the one with the girls talking about the pain in her head, and she's trying to explain it to her boyfriend. There's actually a nail sticking out the front of her forehead.
Oh no, I haven't seen that.
And it's all about how women want men to listen.
Yeah.
Listen to how they're feeling, not fix the problem. And he's trying to say, well, if I just pull the nail out of your head, it'll be fixed. So I'll see if I can send that to you. I think it's quite hilarious. Okay, I'm particularly intrigued by your world building in your fantasy work. That's most of your work that I've read has been the fantasy. Now, in terms of Sea Hearts, I described it as reading your stories as looking through aged glass. You know, the worlds are familiar, but distorted ever so slightly. And I was just wondering, is that something that you consciously aim for in your writing, or is it a consequence of playing with folklore, or both?
It's probably a bit of both. I think what I want it to be, I want the worlds to be realistic enough to be believable. I want you to feel, you know, the actual sensations of being there as far as I can get them to you. But I don't want you to be able to say, oh yeah, that's just those crazy people in the Outer Hebrides, Scotland. We won't, we don't really need to apply that to ourselves. So I want them to sort of, I want them to hover just above reality, so that you can feel that you're right there, but you can't quite pin it down to exactly where it is in the world. Therefore, you can't dismiss it on the basis of being a very far away place or a very long ago time.
So just close enough to make you feel a little uncomfortable.
Yeah. Or just to feel that you could believably step into that world and be part of it. But strange enough for you to think, where exactly is this? So to be just slightly questioning where it is all the time, which can be madly irritating to some readers, I acknowledge, but that's what I like to do.
Fair enough. I don't mind it. I find both your long and your short fiction delivers considerably engaging emotional content, and I've got no shame in admitting I cried when I read Singing My Sister Down. I found Tender Morsels confronting in a number of ways, and one of your most recent, Significant Dust, nearly broke me again. Do the seeds of your stories start with the emotional content, or do you lead your characters so they go, you know, into areas that you're uncomfortable with and you want to explore?
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit like picking at a scab, isn't it? I sort of start off with what I think is just an interesting story, an interesting idea, like the idea of the for Significant Dust, it was just, well, the location was so weird out on the Nullarbor, but there were also some news stories about UFOs there, and I had spent a bit of time, you know, working in a roadhouse on the Nullarbor, so I knew at least one location very well. So just that sort of feeling that you have your finger on all the pulses of that one tiny place is a good indication that you can use it for a story. And then to throw in the speculative bit, to throw in the UFO, just sort of took it to another level. But I needed a reason for this girl to be there and to encounter the UFO herself, or nearly encounter the UFO herself, or want to encounter the UFO herself. So in the process of making that a sensible thing for her to want to do, I had to build in all this other backstory about her family and her sister, for whom she'd been she'd been responsible for making her a quadriplegic. So once I started exploring that, then the emotional stuff starts just coming through for her. And so I'm not really talking about problems that are necessarily related to my own life, but in the course of poking and prodding at these imaginary stories, other things come up for me, I guess, which give emotional power to the narrative.
We'll keep on doing it because it makes you... it's not unique to you, but I find there's very few writers that I have that emotional sort of connection, or sometimes dread that something bad's going to happen. Probably Karen Warren's another person that I can find does that in her short fiction. And Kat Sparks, I just started reading her work the other night, and it,
Well, I'm very proud to be among the people who can make you cry, Sean.
Can put that on the book cover.
That's right.
Make Sean cry. Now, I have heard, and I'm not sure where I heard this or where I read it, that you might have been just listening to you or reading you on Twitter, that you handwrite your stories first.
Mm-hmm.
And having written most of my creative work on a word processor, my hand cramps just at the thought of writing out longhand. But I just wondered, was this a long ago established habit, or do you feel that there's a difference in handwriting as opposed to using word processor, and that's integral to the way you write and think and get words down on paper?
Well, it's a bit of both, because I have been writing an awfully long time, but I also think that there's... the thing is that I first started using computers as a work thing, and so they have this worky ambience. So when I get to a worky part of writing a story, which is getting it neatly printed out and slightly distanced from me, and ready to encounter as an editor rather than as a reader vomiting more stuff up, then it makes sense for me to use a computer. But while I'm just at the pouring the stuff out of my head and my guts, it seems more... I suppose it's more intimate. I suppose it just feels more direct to be sitting there and putting it out through your hand with a pen. And also there's never the fear that you are going to lose it. This was an early fear. This is not so much a fear these days, because our computers are a lot more reliable. But there was this fear early in the life of computers that everything would crash and you would lose a day's work. But also... if you're working at the kitchen table and the internet is right there in your laptop, it takes quite a bit of willpower not to go and tweet and Facebook. If you're feeling very fierce, you can do that. You can actually do your writing like I can sit down and I can edit a short story on a computer, so I can do some reasonably creative work on screen, but I really feel more comfortable and more sort of dedicated to what I'm doing if I've printed it out and I've gone to a place where there is no internet and I'm working on the hard copy. Alan Baxter laughs at me for this, but it's probably a lot of other people do too, but it just feels as if having the whole thing there and being able to see and to feel exactly where you are in a large manuscript, so you can actually feel the weight of what's come before and what's coming after, makes more sense than doing it on an endlessly scrolling screen where you've only got a few figures down the bottom which tell you where you are. So it's all a combination of mild neuroses and long habit. I mean, I probably could just about put together a really short story from scratch on screen these days in the right relaxed circumstances. But I also think that is not a physically healthy thing for me to do, because I find that when I'm trying to compose or even when I am editing on screen, I get much more pain in my wrists and arms than I do working on hard copy. So there's something about being there poised with your hands in the typing position, which is not very good for my arms and shoulders. So it's better if I am just relaxedly typing in copy from a hard copy than if I'm trying to generate copy. So lots of complicated reasons.
No, it's interesting because I did participate in February in an online poetry, post-it note poetry thing where, you would handwrite your poem on a post-it note, photograph it, stick it up on the internet.
Yeah, you didn't have much time there for your hands to crack up.
No, that was good. But I think it, because what I would do then was I would take myself away from the computer and just sit down on the floor or wherever and just write it.
Mm.
And it's so much easier when you've not got other things that you can, distract yourself with.
Yeah.
But I wondered also too if there was, in handwriting it down, there's no compulsion to go back and go, okay, that's a misspelt word, I'll just fix that up so it looks nice. So there's no sort of editing perhaps beyond just crossing a word out and writing what you want to write.
You can't really undo things besides, drawing a line through them. But the beauty of it also is that if you're really fumbling for a story and you're not quite sure what direction you're going to go in, you can blunder along for several pages on what you think is the wrong, what you eventually decide is the wrong direction. And then you can undo that. And then further down the line when you realise, no, actually that was the way you were going to go, you haven't gone back and completely disappeared it. So you can retrieve things a lot easier with a handwritten copy than with an electronic one, unless you obsessively save everything, which I tend not to. I try and keep the different drafts and keep everything visible as I'm going and keep the different drafts separate.
Okay, version 500.
No, I don't want my head can't cope with too many versions of things.
Okay, I see your work shelved in the teen section in my library, and I often wonder if that categorisation has been a boon or a barrier, and do you think recent happenings like the Stella shortlisting might help you reach more adult readers?
Well, one always hopes so. I mean, if you're going to be put in a ghetto, then the YA ghetto is a really good ghetto to be put in, because it's really flourishing at the moment. It's doing so incredibly well. But it's, I don't know whether it's just because, is this what we think of our teenagers or what? But it seems to not have the same, people tend, the general public, I would say, the people who you meet once in a group of people, who find out that you're a writer. If you're not in the literary mainstream, they're kind of mystified about where you fit in. I've always assumed that people have a lot more knowledge of the different genres than they generally do. But mostly they seem to think it's Miles Franklin winners or rubbish. That's the message that they they generally get from the media, I think. Or they have no idea what's been going on in YA, which is fine too. But they tend to say, "Oh yes, well, tell me about your book. I might get it for my niece, or for my cousin." So I think there are, in a way, it's often genres are used as an excuse to not read things because we all have so much on our plates that we can never read as much as we would like. But mostly I would say it has been a boon because I think that when I first started writing and I was trying to be literary, those stories were not really working for me. And then as it's not so much the YA as the speculative fiction genre thing, that my stories just got weirder and weirder, and speculative fiction gave me a place where they would fit. But with YA, I don't know. It's a long time ago because the first YA I wrote was back in the mid-90s. And I had, at that stage, I had written a lot of teenage romances. Sorry, this is a very rambling answer. I'd written a lot of teenage romances and I'd written a couple of junior fiction, junior fantasies. And then I did a couple of gritty realist YA novels, and I think those were the ones that got me pitched into the YA genre and kept me stuck there, because once I moved over to fantasy, I did for a while try and keep one foot in the YA schoolyard and make sure that there were a couple of actual YA stories in the collections that I put out, but after a while I decided that was not a sensible thing to do for the writing, that I should just write the stories that came and not think about audiences. And so since then, there have been stories that happen to be okay for YA audiences and stories that happen to not be okay for YA audiences, and I've sort of gone on this double track ever since.
Oh, that was going to lead into my next question, but you've answered it there. And I just wondered if, you know, that branding of you as a YA author caused a kind of self-censorship, a reining in of your desire to explore certain murky depths. And, I suppose what you're saying.
Really, because I got very annoyed with what has happened to YA and this is partly why this new category called new adult is rearing its ugly head. The fact that as it went along, you know, it started out to be really quite an edgy and quite an adventurous category in the mid-90s when I got into it. Australia was doing really well in this field. It was being very bold and facing a lot of truths and, you know, dealing with a lot of material that children's books hadn't been dealing with. And then as the years went on, YA kind of got the age band that it was aimed at grew younger and younger. I think it was when the Americans came into the field, I don't know how it happened, but all of a sudden people were saying, I can't give this to my 13-year-old, and I had never written YA for 13-year-olds. That was never my intention. And there was also the thing that I always assumed that young adult shaded into adult at the top, so there was some territory in the older ages of the band where, you know, well, of course you'd lose the younger readers because you were dealing with the stuff that 17-year-olds were facing, and 18-year-olds and 20-year-olds. But this seemed to be not so much a thing anymore. So not so much. I wouldn't say that there was self-censorship. I think there was a certain amount of reshaping of stories just to make it possible for my publishers to still publish me in the area in which they knew I had something of a market. So I wouldn't say that the stories were really bent out of shape. They were written, like with Tender Morsels, which has all that sexual violence in it. I wrote it in a particular way because I knew that it was going to, in some areas, be sold as YA. So I was very careful around those scenes, not to make them graphic, not to rub people's noses in the awful details. But when I think back on it, I think if I had actually let those details in, it would have not succeeded as a book in the way that it does now, because it would have turned into a book about sexual violence instead of a book about the recovery from awful things and the way people deal with trauma. So it's a bit hard to say what was intentional and what wasn't, but I think that it was a more coherent book for having forced to confront the fact that it might be YA for some people.
Yeah, and I was just thinking perhaps, you know, not having that detail for me makes it a little bit more terrifying. I think if you leave the reader to do some, you know, a little bit of lifting, then, you know, sometimes our own imaginations can provide more emotion than perhaps what an author can do just by spelling it out for us.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that it, for the... I think I was a bit too successful at it in some ways, because a lot of adult readers actually thought that those scenes were present in the novel. They actually complained of graphic sex scenes, and there actually weren't any. They would cut out just before the graphic stuff started.
But yeah, no, so it was their own sort of suggestive reading of the book was...
That's right, yeah, it was a problem for them, yeah. So I figured... Yeah, I don't have to worry about you.
No, fair enough. Getting towards the end of my questions now, there's only a couple left, but gritty, realistic adult fantasy seems to be the in thing. Certainly we've got Game of Thrones and Joe Abercrombie's First Law trilogy, but I often find the authors highlighted almost exclusively men, and I find both yourself and... Rowena Corey Daniels can be emotionally gritty and honest, in some ways more emotionally true. And I'm just thinking of Goosal here. I was wondering what your thoughts were on writing dark, cynical, or realistic fantasy, and why the big deal is made about those other authors that I mentioned, the male authors, when it comes to edgy fantasy. And do you think there's a gender component there? Are we sort of sectioning off women writers and saying, well, women don't write this edgy stuff, when I think they do?
Yeah, I think we do. I think there's always a gender thing going on. I think that, you know, we all, us dark women fantasy writers, tend to be, you know, sold in a bit of a sort of wafty Stevie Nicks kind of a way sometimes, rather than being given a decent fierce cover and being included in the big guns. But there, you know, there's a lot of things at work there. There's a lot of traditions. There are a lot of cliques and clubs. Yeah, I mean, I don't feel any more hot-headed about it than I do about the general gender things that are happening in the world, I suppose. It's something, it's just, you know, an extra, you have to make an extra amount of noise for yourself and assert yourself in slightly different ways to make yourself heard.
Yeah, I mean, I try and drop, when I'm visiting forum boards or discussions on tor.com or somewhere, I always try and at least drop in two or three names of women writers that I know are writing stuff that I find is probably... I feel it's more gritty and realistic. I mean, as much as I quite enjoy Game of Thrones, A Song of Ice and Fire, the book series, I don't think I've ever quite had the same emotional reactions that I have had with, you know, the Australian women authors who are writing dark fantasy can give me, yourself included in that. So I think it's just a travesty, because readers are missing out. But
a lot of people don't want to look at their emotions, you know. A lot of people don't want to be moved. A lot of people just want to, you know, get through the quest and put on the body armor.
All right. Well, this question's the last one.
Okay.
In Australia, it's been a good year for women, at least in the sense of being heard, or perhaps just a better year. Our PM let fly with a rousing speech on misogyny, and obviously the Stella was launched. And I was just wondering what you thought our corner, and that being the speculative fiction corner of Australian literature, how does that hold up in regards to gender equality, do you think?
I think it's pretty good. I think we've got so many strong and active women in the genre community that we can't help but have an equal voice. I don't know whether it's just me seeing like-minded people because, you know, they're my mates, but I look around the genre scene and it doesn't feel to me male dominated. Any con you go to is alive with women on stage and in the audience speaking their minds and doing their own thing. I don't feel particularly nervous. I think I feel less despair. Doesn't that sound like damning the same phrase? No. I think, you know, looking overseas and seeing how the very entrenched speculative fiction scene is battling with these issues. Just hanging around on Twitter this morning and having a look at Cameron Hurley's spiel about Sufwa, and the entrenched sexism that's in the scene over there makes me think, oh well, possibly there is a corner of that over here in Australia, but it's so small that in the overview of conventions and activities that's going on in spec fic, it's not the ruling way of looking at what we're doing, what we're writing, what we're thinking anymore. I feel comfortable with this scene. I don't think there are no battles to fight, but I think that they're not quite such entrenched ones as they're battling over in the US and probably the UK as well.
No, I would, with my limited contact with conventions, having gone to one, I didn't see. I didn't see, and that may be because I'm male and generally don't see on a basic sort of cultural level, but I certainly didn't come across any people in the bar that were sort of uncomfortably openly sexist or telling off jokes, that sort of thing. It seemed where I have gone to, maybe it's just where I live, but I've been to events around where I live, which is a conservative area, I suppose, and people that are not that much older than me, do drop these sort of sexist bombs every now and again in speeches. I think we're doing well, and unfortunately I haven't had the chance to go overseas and witness things for myself, but obviously we should get all the best women writers from around the world, and they should all come and live in Australia.
I think everybody should come here for a visit and see how we do it, and then take home the good stuff. A bit like what happened with YA.
All right. Well, that's the last of my questions, Margot. I just wanted to thank you very much for getting up so early, and thank you for coming on the podcast.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Sean.